Your Fitbit or Apple Watch, they know so much about you and your health, but who else has access to that data?
The technology is racing so far ahead of the law that there's this giant loophole.
I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
We are, in effect, trying to turn the patient's own tumor into a vaccine.
The real question is, should somebody somewhere on this planet be trying to solve this problem?
Nothing matters as much as where you do your residency.
This is the first generation. They're putting a Model T in my chest.
The only natural disaster that we can actually do something about.
We were dead wrong.
If stress puts
any
you at risk for
So what this produces is a protein that tells the cells to divide. And what they'll do is they'll divide.
That's what the leak said.
Okay, we're all done. You did great.
On today's show, lovely, clean smells that might be bad for us, stinky, smelly cheeses that hold important science lessons, and a look at a chemical in our water that's both lauded and contested. But first up, this morning I swam some laps, I had eggs for breakfast, and I recorded all of this important information in an app called MyFitnessPal, so I can check out my entire history of all the things I ate for months and months back. But who else can see that? Who has access to our health information? For our series, Bit by Bit, How Data is Shaping Our Health, Carolyn Beeler investigates.
It's about 5 p.m. on a Friday, happy hour at the Center City, Philadelphia offices of the tech firm Think Brownstone. While his colleagues chat over beers upstairs, Vice President of Experience Design Phil Chiron is in a meeting room downstairs, finally setting up the Apple Watch that arrived earlier in the day.
I was really tempted to not work for the rest of the day. I really wanted to sit. It was kind of tough.
At long last, the moment came.
And we opened them out of these beautiful boxes.
Oh, wow. There's like some graphic of like the cosmos there on your watch.
You have to hold the phone up to the watch, and then it recognizes the phone and says they're paired. That was pretty quick.
On the back of the watch are tiny lenses that are part of an optical heart rate sensor. Inside is an accelerometer, which counts steps and calculates calories burned. Chiron wanted the watch because of its health functions.
I mean, if I had like a scale at home that could keep track of my weight, I'd love to have all of my health data in one place.
Experienced designer Sun Quan Bush got the second watch in the office's rotating watch share.
The most interesting thing is when I started setting up the health part, you know, I could actually see my heart rate. It also asked my age, my weight, gender, my activity level, and then it started giving me goals.
This Apple Watch is far from the first activity tracker, and it's not the most sophisticated wearable. Others measure blood oxygen levels, brain activity, and REM sleep. Mobile apps do everything from reminding you when to take your medication to tracking your period. Penn privacy researcher Tim Liebert says these products are ushering in the wild west of health data.
Things that happen outside of a doctor's office, that being your apps, your fitness trackers, your gym memberships, none of that stuff is protected by HIPAA.
HIPAA is the privacy law that limits who has access to your clinical health records.
In terms of what's going on with your fitness trackers or websites in the U.S., for the most part, that's completely unregulated at a federal level. So most of the regulations in that space are self-regulations, and we've seen over the past 10, 20 years that the industry does not police itself virtually at all.
A big recent exception is how Apple is policing apps that tap into health information and use the Apple Watch's heart rate sensor. Morgan Reed is the head of the App Association, a D.C.-based trade organization that represents software companies.
Apple really put a flag in the ground when they came out with their Apple Watch and a set of developer agreements that really defined how we can use the data. They did two things that are really original and are going to be something that I think sets the tone for everyone else.
First, Apple leaves your personal health data on your device. It doesn't automatically upload it to the cloud, and it lets you choose which apps to share it with.
The second part is they made a bright line restriction on the use of this data for targeted behavioral advertising. What that means is that your information can't be used to say, oh, you have this health condition. We're going to show you ads specific to your personal health condition.
Apple also says your health data can't be sold to advertisers. It has yet to be seen how well the company will enforce these rules, but even setting them is outside the industry norm. A Federal Trade Commission study presented last year found that information gathered by 12 mobile health and fitness apps was transmitted to 76 different third parties, including advertisers. That information on exercise routines, diet, and symptom searches could be re-identified back to individual consumers, according to the FTC. Now, selling data is by no means new. It's how Facebook and Google make their money. Tim Liebert is skeptical that app developers will follow Apple's privacy lead as they start to gather more sensitive health data.
I mean, if you're giving away a free app, the money has to come from someplace. So the likelihood that you're going to say everything's encrypted, we can't see everything, and we can never look at it, well, then how do you make money, right?
This personal information is the currency of the digital age. John Wilbanks from the nonprofit biomedical research firm Sage BioNetworks fears our health data is starting to be viewed like any other consumer information.
What we have in sort of consumer culture is really fine-grained stratification of people so that we know that, you know, you're more likely to buy a yellow sweater and I'm more likely to buy a blue sweater.
Wilbanks worked on the participant consent policies for Apple's secure research apps, and he's especially worried about what happens if insurance companies have access to this detailed health information.
It becomes easy to say, I'm not, you know, going to deny you insurance because of factors X, Y, and Z. It says, oh, you know, I simply used all of this data and people like you tend to have a bad health record, so I'm not going to give you insurance at a good rate because my data has put you into this risk pool. And that risk pool would not have been knowable before wearables. And so that's one of the big fears, and I think it's a valid one.
Obamacare outlaws insurance price hikes based on health status in the individual market, but generally does allow it in employer-based coverage. Companies already incorporate the fitness tracker Fitbit into corporate wellness programs, and at least one life insurance company offers discounts to customers who wear one and share the data. For the record, Fitbit emphatically says it does not sell personal data without consent. Back at the tech company Think Brownstone, Sun Quan Bush and Phil Sharon aren't bothered by the capabilities of their new watches.
I suppose I should be creeped out, but it's kind of cool.
At this point, I'm not worried about someone else seeing that data. If I gained 5 pounds and Apple finds out, I don't think Johnny Ive cares.
For now, which health information is collected and shared is largely up to the tech industry. What's up to the consumer is whether the help you get, tracking your steps or calories or heart rate, is worth giving up some privacy. As they say about free stuff online, if you're not paying for it, you are the product. For The Pulse, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And if you care about what information your apps collect from you, Tim Liebert recommends actually reading your privacy policies. I know it's a major drag, but look for any clauses that reserve the right to share or sell your data. And if you want to keep your health information private, don't use health and fitness apps on public Wi-Fi. You've been warned. It's The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. The death toll from the 7.9 magnitude earthquake that hit Nepal last week continues to rise, and millions of people are without shelter. A massive rebuilding effort for Kathmandu will have to get underway very quickly, but what could be done to prevent similar devastation during future quakes? Joining us now to talk about that is Ross Stein. He's an emeritus scientist at the U.S. Geological Survey and a consulting professor of geophysics at Stanford University. Ross, thank you for being here.
I'm happy to be here.
Ross, can you describe what happened geologically in Nepal that created this quake?
Well, India has been in a 40 million year long slow-mo collision into Tibet. And what's happened is that the people, and if you think of a car crashing in, the people in the front seat of the car have already found that the engine has been shoved into the passenger's compartment, but the people in the back seat of the car don't even know that an accident is in progress. So central and southern India is relatively unaffected, but northern India is the collision zone of this monstrous crash, and that's what pushes Tibet upward so it's the roof of the world.
And what are the conditions in Kathmandu and the surrounding areas that caused the dramatic destruction and the loss of life that we saw?
Well, first, any earthquake of this size, magnitude 7.8, proves very destructive to any structures that aren't very well built. And to make matters worse, the population of Nepal is pushing itself into Kathmandu. So it's one of these super cities of the world that is rapidly populating and long since ran out of wood. So construction is stone and masonry, and it's impoverished. And not only does that mean that the damage can be colossal, it's complicated even further or made worse because Kathmandu is basically a bowl of jello that shakes harder than anything else around it in an earthquake.
How so?
Well, the people live in flat places. All big cities are in flat places. And on Earth, to get a flat place, it means you have a pile of sediments. And so those sediments tend to shake very hard in an earthquake. It's as if I beat on a drum skin. Then I repeat this experiment, but I pour sand on the drum skin first. As you can imagine, the sand's going to go for quite more of a ride than the drum skin. And that's what happens in Kathmandu and cities like it.
Now, you described the way buildings are made in Kathmandu. Let's say the same kind of quake would happen in Los Angeles, for example. What kind of destruction might we see in that kind of city?
It's a good question because that size earthquake has already occurred in the greater Los Angeles area, but before it was populated in 1857. Exact same size of earthquake as this one. But the big difference, the profound difference, is the quality of the construction. We have building codes in the United States which are fairly strictly enforced, and those codes provide what's called minimal life safety. A building is simply not supposed to come down. It may not ever be used again, but it won't kill and entomb the people in it. And as a result, if this same earthquake were repeated in broader Los Angeles, the impact would be much, much less than it is here.
I watched a TED talk you gave where you talk about the fact that we like to build in cubes or stacks of cubes. And then you said, but cubes have no structural integrity. How so? We think of a cube as a fairly solid thing.
Isn't that funny? So we all should take a page from Buckminster Fuller, who showed us that really integrity comes from triangles. And geodesic domes, his wonderful creation of domes, are an example of a structure that's built purely with triangles and no cubes. And if we all lived in domes, earthquakes would be fun. There'd be no damage at all because they're light, they're strong, and they don't collapse. And in contrast, the problem with a cube is it can twist itself into being absolutely flat. So a cube is only held up by the internal triangles. And to strengthen buildings, we simply add internal triangles.
But I guess the problem with domes is that you can't stack them on top of each other. And in a lot of these big cities, everybody's living literally on top of each other.
You're right. It's so sad that domes aren't stackable. Because what happens in the developing world, in Nepal and so many other places, is a building is built maybe a few stories high. To recoup the investment, maybe the bottom story is retail space with big glass windows, so it's got no triangles. And as the family grows, another story and then another is built on top of it that it was never intended to take. So the combination of these unengineered additions to the weight and height of the building, plus the vulnerability of its soft first story, these buildings are weak at the knees. And what happens in city after city in great earthquakes is the bottom story collapses and the rest of the building drops on top of it. And each successive floor, as it falls, collapses further.
And the fatalities in earthquakes have risen dramatically in recent decades, right?
They have, and that's probably not because we're building more poorly. It's because the population is flowing into megacities, and many of those are astride the great plate boundaries. And as a result, we're creating the targets of chance. If you happen to have an earthquake near Kathmandu or Port-au-Prince, Haiti, or we can think of many other places where we hope it won't happen. Tehran, for example, or Manila in the Philippines, or Caracas, Venezuela, or Quito, Ecuador, then we create the conditions for a truly colossal disaster, which never could have existed before because we didn't put 10 million, 20 million people into one city living cheek by jowl in poorly engineered structures.
Ross, thank you so much for talking with us.
I'm happy to do so.
Ross Stein is a consulting professor of geophysics at Stanford University, and that TED Talk I mentioned is really worth watching. We've linked to it on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. It's The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. If you drink tap water, you're getting a daily dose of fluoride. That's something public health people consider one of their top achievements of the 20th century because it reduces cavities. Trust me, I know because I grew up without fluoride in my water in Germany, and I have the cavities to prove it. The federal government just changed its recommendations on how much fluoride should be in the water, and that prompted us to take a look at this whole concept, which faced and continues to face quite a bit of opposition. Here's Tanya English.
One of the first studies on fluoride in water was in Grand Rapids, Michigan, back in 1945. Dentist Howard Pollack says the start date for that trial was published in the newspaper. But then the study was temporarily postponed before health officials could notify residents.
All the complaints came in that people were getting rashes, they were feeling bad, all kinds of problems. They thought because of the fluoride starting in the water. Well, in fact, it hadn't actually started yet.
Pollack is a spokesman for the American Dental Association and professor at the University of California, San Francisco School of Dentistry. He says when you look beyond one or two studies at the total evidence, there are no health problems linked to low levels of fluoride in drinking water. Pollack says adding fluoride protection to municipal water has been a cost-effective strategy for dental health.
It's more of a social justice issue these days where we have to provide what we can for those most vulnerable, those most needy, those that don't have access to the things that you and I might have access to.
Pollack first became a dentist in 1967.
The decay was rampant.
My grandparents, none of them were fairly educated people. They didn't have their teeth when they were 60 years old.
That's Christopher Hughes. He leads the pediatric clinic at the Rutgers School of Dental Medicine.
You know, the improvement in dental health over the last century is phenomenal. And a lot of this is attributable to fluoridation of communal water supplies. It's an undeniable fact.
This week, the federal government lowered its recommendation on the optimal fluoride level in water. But officials didn't cite health problems. Instead, there's a cosmetic issue. Too much fluoride can create white spots on the teeth of very young children. The condition is called fluorosis.
This is not an exaggeration. You could be married to someone for 30 years and not know they had mild or very mild fluorosis. This is something that only a dentist would be able to discriminate.
Today, nearly every toothpaste at the drugstore has fluoride. And critics say that's a better way to protect people from tooth decay. Use fluoride directly on the teeth, then spit it out.
We now know that fluoride doesn't need to be swallowed. And if there's no need to swallow it, why are we adding it to the water where you have to swallow it?
Michael Conant is an attorney for the Fluoride Action Network. He says people who don't want fluoride in their water should have that option.
And so there's a real consumer choice issue that's being neglected by the government's policy.
The new water standard is the first update from the U.S. Public Health Service since 1962.
I think it's telling that it took so long for government health authorities to finally act on the obvious. You know, I think there's a nebulous sense that this issue was resolved long time ago, the science was settled 50 or 60 years ago, and the only people who oppose it are a bunch of crackpots. And it's really not the case.
Conant says it's been hard to communicate health concerns about the newer science on fluoride because so much cultural baggage still dogs the debate. For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
Coming up, a creative outlet for stressed out doctors.
This gold-plated, hand-stitched, velvet-lined couture box is a place to hide every emotion you simply don't have time to feel, so that you can save them for later.
Still to come on The Pulse, right here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and strives to lead the way with a focus on preventing illness rather than reacting to it. That's why they're proud to offer health programs, including fitness reimbursements and health coaches, to help keep you healthy. And it's why they're proud to sponsor programs and events around the city like the Blue Cross Broad Street Run and Indigo, Philadelphia's first bike share program. More at ibx.com and rideindigo.com. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Supporting WHYY's The Pulse, AstraZeneca believes that some of the most exciting innovations arise from external collaborations. With approximately 850 partnerships around the world, AstraZeneca aims to accelerate new ideas into innovative medicines by teaming with distinguished scientists and academic institutions and like-minded science-led companies that contribute complementary technologies, know-how, and molecules. Learn more at openinnovation.astrazeneca.com.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. Think about a time when you had a bad interaction with a doctor. Maybe they seemed cold, distracted, not interested in what you had to say. And maybe you thought, what a jerk. But what if that doctor was really just burned out? This is a big problem in medicine, and it starts happening in medical school, especially in year three when students interact more with patients. On a daily basis, people who work in healthcare see really difficult situations, a lot of pain, suffering, and even death. In an attempt to inoculate students against this loss of empathy, there is an experiment underway at a Philadelphia medical school. The treatment? Theater. Alana Gordon reports.
The laboratory for this experiment is a room on the third floor of Thomas Jefferson University's Hamilton building. First-year medical student Catherine Linder says, now imagine it's a stage.
Certainly this is not a theater space, but we made it our own pseudo black box.
And now imagine at the center of that stage is one of the main characters, the brainchild of second-year Yasmin Kukaz.
A miniature invisible unicorn.
A miniature invisible unicorn?
It's a metaphor.
I mean, it is symbolic.
Kukaz, with the help of fourth-year med student Jonathan Yadlowski, explains this unicorn grew up in clouds made of pie. Kukaz flips through the pages of the story she wrote as part of a theater class.
And then she comes to medical school, and she lives in a syringe.
That sounds terrible.
Yeah.
I loved this play.
I did, too. Yeah, I really did, too.
Thank you.
Kukaz spent weeks hashing out this play in a four-month course that met weekly in this room. About 24 people participated, mostly students, but some doctors, too. Again, first-year Kat Linder.
We talked about faith in medicine through one person's story. We talked about loss. Really, nothing was off the table, which, at least so far in the first-year curriculum, we don't really have a platform for that. There's no avenue for that.
Some worry that platform, that stage, doesn't exist at all in medicine. That's even though people working in healthcare have a front row seat witnessing pain, suffering, and the realities of being human.
It's almost ironic that people that are seeing the human condition at its worst have no tools to metabolize what that means.
This is Dr. Sal Mangione. He teaches physical diagnosis at Jefferson. He says students are trained to memorize lots of information, to observe, to diagnose. But he sees a lot of soon-to-be doctors lose something along the way, their empathy, and even worse, a part of themselves. That can lead to poor patient care and burnout.
And we are the profession with a high suicide rate. So clearly something breaks. On the other hand, if you ask why and what, that becomes much more difficult.
Mangione has a theory that creative outlets like theater could build up and protect those parts of the brain and soul that get damaged during school and even later in practice.
Theater seemed to me like an ideal platform to foster tolerance of ambiguity, empathy, and basically catharsis.
He thinks it's here, in this safe, fictional space, that people can get closer to that very real exploration of the human condition. So Mangione, a self-described theater fanatic, connected with Lantern Theater Company around the corner from the school to help design a class. The result? Nearly 30 plays written by students and other health workers.
Did someone there cause his heart attack? Tell me, doctor, was there something that could have been done to prevent the heart attack?
Do you mean something I could have done?
These are actors from Lantern rehearsing a play a doctor wrote about ethical challenges of learning important information from a patient.
But why couldn't you have Khalil?
Ms. Salam, I want to tell you something else about Khalil.
What? Tell me!
One of the purposes of theater is to be a place where you can face your fears or your inadequacies, and you can wrestle with the large questions of what kind of a world you want to be in, and who are you in that world.
Kitson O'Neill is with Lantern and helped lead the course. She says a really big part of the playwriting process involved helping students recognize their own biases and exploring the other side.
Just the pure act of making a play forces you to think empathetically from the point of view of someone who is different from you.
Again, first year Yasmin Kukas.
It gave me a new perspective on how to see people, both patients and just like day to day. Because you really, I think you start to get a more like interactive, like 3D understanding of who someone actually is.
Kukas found the whole experience energizing. She and others filled out surveys before and after the class. Mangione, the doctor, now hopes to assess and track whether his theory about theater and medicine is having any real effect. And while the curtains may have closed on stage one of this experiment, Kukas is thinking of writing a sequel. It's about the invisible unicorn in her second year, studying for her boards. For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
And if you want to see a selection of these performances, we've put all the details on our website at whyy.org/thepulse. Last Sunday, we sent three science fans out on a mission. They were supposed to hit as many Philadelphia Science Festival events as humanly possible in one day. They had 23 events to choose from. Here's a quick excerpt from my post-competition interview with Kennedy Allen, co-producer and host of the Black Tribbles podcast, Adrienne Simpson, freelance writer, and Tegan Karuna, a communications fellow at the National Cancer Institute and host of the Action Phase podcast. Here, Kennedy is talking about the favorite place she visited.
I think the one that was most remarkable would have to be the Wagner Institute, the Wagner Free Institute of Science at 1700 West Montgomery Avenue in North Philly. I lived in North Philly for 3.5, almost 4 years, never knew that place was up there. This Victorian era, gorgeous museum filled with just bundles and bundles and bundles of information.
Adrienne, you tweeted, "I'm in love," when you walked into the Wagner Institute. What did you fall in love with?
I felt the same way Kennedy did. It's like this hidden gem. It's very unexpected. It has this incredible retro feel that gives you this respect for what Philadelphia means in sort of the scientific community and the history of learning for this country. So I loved it. I was mesmerized.
Tegan, what was your biggest kind of lesson from the day, takeaway point?
I was astonished at how much science history there is in the city and how many resources there are that somebody who already cares about science and innovation and all those kinds of things had no idea that was there.
Adrienne won with 11 events and then followed by Tegan with 8, and then Kennedy, you hit 7 events.
Cool.
So pretty amazing all around. And Adrienne, your prize is the ultimate nerd glory, I guess. The queen of the science festival.
I'm in all my nerd glory, my Philly nerd glory right now. I couldn't be happier. I'd like to thank Sir Isaac Newton.
And we have that whole interview with Kennedy, Adrienne, the queen of the science festival, and Tegan on our website at whyy.org/thepulse. And there's a lot more info in there on hidden science gems right under our noses. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. There was a time in America when your cheese choices were pretty much limited to yellow and white, which coincidentally tasted pretty much the same. But specialty stores kept the flame for variety in food alive, among them Formaggio Kitchen in Cambridge. Famous chef Julia Child was a loyal customer there. But these days, the wonderfully stinky cheeses also attract scientists from Harvard and Tufts. Reporter Allison Bruzek has this story.
You know, one of the most important things that I can tell you about cheese is that taste before you buy and buy what you need.
This is Ihsan Gurdell.
I'm co-owner of Formaggio Kitchen with my wife, Valerie Gurdell.
Ihsan knows a lot about cheese. He's been working at Formaggio Kitchen for over 30 years. Formaggio is a specialty store in Cambridge, Massachusetts. It carries wines, olive oil, fresh produce, and every type of cheese you can imagine.
We actually buy cheeses from single shepherds. That cheeses that don't even make it to Paris. They're consumed mostly where they are in the Pyrenees.
But some of the most interesting cheeses aren't above ground, they're below. Ihsan takes me down into the bowels of Formaggio. That's where he's dug out his cheese caves, two to be exact, each about the size of a small closet. Each cave is really a room covered with wooden shelves stocked with row after row of aging cheeses. The smell is overwhelming, like old socks blended with basement mold.
These are mostly natural rind cheeses around us, with few exception of some Dutch cheeses with paraffin on them. Right next to us, we have Piemontese mountain cheeses, cow's milk.
The caves are cooler than the upstairs store, kept around 45 degrees Fahrenheit. They're also very wet, with humid air. A small fountain gurgles in the middle of one of them.
This breaks the water, so there's a very, very gentle mist coming out of it.
This atmosphere allows the microbes that make the cheese delicious to flourish, and there are a lot of them.
You know, people pick up a piece of cheese and they think of it as this beautiful, simple, you know, lawn of mold, and they put it in their mouth and don't think anymore. But actually, on a cheese rind, it's really war and peace.
That's Benjamin Wolfe, a biology professor at Tufts University, about a 15-minute drive from Formaggio Kitchen. He and his colleagues recently finished a study using 137 samples from Ihsan's cave and all over the world. They found cheesemakers could essentially engineer the microbes on their cheeses. So cheeses in two different caves could grow identical bacteria, while cheeses in the same cave could be entirely different. It all depended on the cave's temperature, humidity, the types of natural bacteria in the air, and how often the cheeses were rubbed.
We find bacteria, we find yeast, and we find molds. And then with each of those, we see some really interesting groups. So in the bacteria, we see some microbes that are similar to the microbes that grow in the human microbiome. So the reason that your feet smell bad is because there's a group of bacteria known as Brevibacterium that produce some sulfur compounds. And those similar types of bacteria grow on cheese, which is why some cheeses smell pretty terrible.
And that's actually the point of studying cheese. Benjamin says the more we learn about bacteria and fungi on cheese, the more we'll know about how similar bacteria and fungi work elsewhere, like on humans.
And so once we figure out the assembly rules, the principles that govern how all these parts come together, we can start thinking about how that may happen in these more complicated communities and translate some of our findings from cheeses, which are simple, to more complicated communities.
For example, if we can learn how to grow certain bacteria on cheese, we'll know more about how to grow helpful bacteria in the human gut, or how to stop harmful fungus from growing on your feet. And because of the war and peace idea that Benjamin mentioned, there's also the possibility of finding new microbes that could help fight bacteria.
So we do see some of these fungi producing antimicrobials, and maybe those will be useful compounds in the future. You know, a lot of these fungi haven't been well studied, so there could be great promise for finding new compounds that would be useful for us.
Back at Formaggio, Ihsan reminds me the caves aren't just for show.
People have the misconception of this, you know, romantic, pretty look. Ours are very functional. They actually serve a purpose. They're really good for the cheeses.
And surprisingly, the research. For The Pulse, I'm Allison Brudzek.
Coming up, making presentations on climate change can be a dangerous job.
They actually took my PowerPoint projector and smashed it on the floor, and they tried to assault me in the foyer, and I had to be escorted out of town by the police.
Stay tuned to The Pulse right here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and strives to lead the way with a focus on preventing illness rather than reacting to it. They are proud to offer health programs, including fitness reimbursements and health coaches. IBX.com. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Supporting WHYY's The Pulse, AstraZeneca believes that collaboration with other scientists and organizations can help accelerate new ideas into innovative medicines. Learn more at openinnovation.astrazeneca.com.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. Remember this scary movie?
In all of this time, 650,000 years, the CO2 level has never gone above 300 parts per million.
Al Gore is going up on a forklift in An Inconvenient Truth to show just how much CO2 levels had risen.
It's already right here. Look how far above the natural cycle this is, and we've done that.
When Al Gore released his documentary, he also trained 1,000 people as Climate Reality Project presenters to continue spreading the message using his famous slideshow. Richard Whiteford was one of the first trainees, and he joins us now to talk about what that work is like almost 10 years in. Richard, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. It's my pleasure, and thank you for having me.
What are some of the basic techniques you learned about driving this topic home?
A lot of the slides that I work with are, some of them are animated, and they're very powerful. They really get the message about climate across in a very powerful way. It's very moving to people who are seeing it. And, you know, I've dealt with some people that didn't believe that climate change was real, and quite a lot of those people decided that it was after having seen the presentation.
What are some of the things you tell them? What are some of your slides you show them?
Well, two of the biggest observations are the loss of glaciers. Glacier National Park used to have 150 glaciers. Now they only have 25, and those are disappearing very fast. The other thing is glaciers in the Arctic and the Antarctic that are melting. You know, we had a big glacier in Antarctic called the Thwaites Glacier that broke off last May in 2014. And that has committed the world to a 4-foot sea level rise probably in the next 4 or 5 decades and about an 11-foot rise in about mid-century of the next century. The other big message, which I call the critical issue, is the amount of carbon we have burnt from about 165 years ago, from about 1850 up to now. We've burned about 500 billion tons of carbon. And it raised the planetary temperature 1 degree. That's the average, the whole average Earth temperature. And scientists are telling us we dare not go above 2 degrees. And this is Celsius that I'm talking about. And that means that we can only burn another 500 billion tons to put us at that 2 degree level. And right now, in inventory, ready to burn, we have 5 times that much carbon. So drill, baby, drill is a disastrous environmental or energy policy, and we have to leave carbon in the ground or humans won't be around.
I'm sure you don't just go around scaring people to death. So what is the message you try to give? Because I guess you want to send people home with a certain message that there is something to be done.
I think we still have the opportunity, if we really put the hammer down and get moving with this, to engineer our way out of this problem. There are all kinds of new inventions happening right now. Solar has really taken off. Wind is doing really well. There's an outfit in Portland, Oregon that has making water pipes with turbines in them so that when you, like Philadelphia, has a really rotten infrastructure. They need to replace all of it because it's very ancient. If they replace the water pipes here in the city with these pipes with turbines in them, they could produce enough electricity in the city that they wouldn't have to rely on carbon-based fuel. And that's how we're going to get ourselves out of this. We have to invent ourselves out, and it will really kickstart the economy if we get moving.
In your career as a climate presenter, what have been some of your most challenging moments? Have you had any big flops?
I didn't have a flop per se, but right before Obama's second election, I was giving a presentation in a theater, movie theater, to about 350 people. and a group of Tea Party people burst in and came down the aisle screaming at the top of their lungs that climate change is a hoax, climate change is a hoax. And they actually took my PowerPoint projector and smashed it on the floor. And then they went out in a mezzanine, and of course the audience left because it was looking pretty violent. And so I went up, and the police had arrived, but they tried to assault me in the foyer. And I had to be escorted out of town by the police, and the person who assaulted me went to jail. So that was what. And I had a very similar incident like that again, and also with the Tea Party. So it was very contentious back during that, you know, right before the election.
What have been some rewarding moments you've had?
Well, I you know, being asked to speak at the UN is very rewarding. This would be my third time speaking there. I spoke in Copenhagen during the COP15 climate summit, and you know, I don't know. I just it's rewarding because I feel that this is such an important message to get people to understand. One of the things that I hear quite frequently from people is people will say, "Thank you for what you do," and that makes it worthwhile to me too.
Richard, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Richard Whiteford is a climate reality presenter, and he was trained by Al Gore after the release of the movie An Inconvenient Truth. This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We've come to associate certain smells with cleanliness. Orange, pine, maybe you like lavender, whatever smells clean to you. But we might be better off getting a whiff of vinegar. Scientists at Drexel University are finding that some of the commercial cleaning products we use indoors can trigger a surprising amount of pollution. Jessica McDonald reports.
Think air pollution, and most people picture hazy smog outside. The kind Michael Waring envisions is harder to see and trapped under a roof.
If you're interested in things like human health and exposure, you really need to ask yourselves, where are people spending the majority of their time? And that happens to be inside buildings.
Waring is an assistant professor at Drexel and heads the school's indoor air quality lab. Inside, he shows me a large stainless steel box that is hooked up to several lines of tubing, and a pump is circulating clean air.
This is essentially a reaction vessel that we use, so the whole purpose of this is to put in stuff, watch what happens, and then measure the stuff that happens as it's coming out of the chamber.
That stuff includes two common ingredients in household cleaners, alpha-terpineol, or pine scent, and D-limonene, the smell of oranges. Both compounds are naturally occurring, and on their own, pretty harmless.
The problem happens when they're reacted with by ozone. They produce oxygenated compounds that tend to form particulate matter in the indoor air, and they also produce things such as formaldehyde.
Waring says it's not entirely clear how dangerous the newly formed substances might be, but small particles are easily inhaled, and formaldehyde is known to cause cancer. That's why he's using the big metal box to begin to characterize the basics of the reaction. One instrument, for example, determines the size of all the particles.
Particles in the air aren't just one size. There are many, many different sizes. They can be just over the size of a molecule, a little bit over that, all the way to about the thickness of a human hair.
So far, Waring has found that when limonene, the orange scent, is mixed with ozone, it produces 3 to 5 times the particulate pollution as the pine scent. It depends on the amount of air exchange and the filtration system in the home, but those pollutants can stick around for up to 10 hours. The driving force behind these indoor reactions actually comes from outside. Ozone is made when nitrogen oxides and volatile organic compounds from car exhaust or power plant emissions react in sunlight. But it's virtually impossible to rid a home of ozone. It comes in every time you open the door or window and seeps through cracks. Better, Waring says, is to just not use the chemicals that ozone loves to react with.
You know, I think there's been kind of a marketing campaign going on in the United States pushing this idea of clean as something you can smell.
Take this commercial for a cleaner with an aroma so strong it wakes up a sleeping hospital patient.
Woo!
That smells clean.
That's the power of Pine Sol, baby.
And I would just encourage people to question that if that's how they feel about cleanliness and they need to smell something that they spray inside their house, and instead try to think of clean as the absence of smell and the absence of odor in the air. That's a much healthier environment.
The fact that the chemicals we use to clean our homes actually pollute the air we breathe is a bit ironic, but it's not the first counterintuitive result Waring has found during his career. As a grad student, he investigated how well so-called ion generators work to clean the air. The machines were popular about 10 years ago and sold at places like the Sharper Image, although they can still be found today. In the process of filtering out particles, the units end up producing ozone, which on its own is a potent pollutant.
And so the devices could actually operate as net particle generators rather than particle removers.
Even though ozone usually comes from outside, Waring says for the most part, outdoor air is beneficial.
If you're in a typical place in Philadelphia, you're not next to a major roadway, etc., it's always pretty good to breathe fresh outdoor air.
It's not understood why, but fresh air seems to boost worker productivity. Commercial buildings with higher ventilation rates, for instance, have fewer employees who call in sick.
Infection rates go down because any indoor emitted things by pathogens by humans are expelled outside more quickly.
And that might even cut down on the need to spray so much cleaner in the first place. For those not ready to give up the indoor battle with dirt, Waring suggests diluting commercial products or using a mix of water and vinegar. For The Pulse, I'm Jessica McDonald.
But I love that orange cleaner smell. All right, fine. Let's head back outside for some fresh air. But then this time of year, this happens. Oh, runny nose, itchy red eyes. I'm right there. You can probably hear it in my voice. It's allergy season. Antihistamines and decongestants offer some relief, but there are people seeking salvation in a natural alternative.
Every flower in Fairmount Park, every weed, every dandelion, they'll be out and collect a nectar.
Local honey has been hailed as a miracle cure among allergy sufferers, but does it work? We sent The Pulse's Alana Gordon to find out.
Grace Kennedy is staring at a shelf of honey inside the Reading Terminal Market. The jars glow in sunlight from a nearby window.
I'm looking at some wildflower honey, and they're all raw and untreated, completely natural.
And they're local. Kennedy says that detail, honey made from bees in this region, drew her to the stand. She's looking for allergy relief.
They're terrible. Itchy eyes, sneezing, my lymph nodes swell up, runny nose. But if I'm just eating honey almost every day, then it's usually pretty fine.
Kennedy is not the only one seeking out local honey for allergies.
How comfortable are you with bees?
We'll find out.
Okay. If a bee starts running, like, you know, bouncing into your face, then you may want to take a walk.
Don Shump is a web developer turned beekeeper. He walks me to a mid-size crate, maybe 1.5 feet long and deep, and lowers my microphone into the opening. Inside is a newly arrived colony of 20,000 or so bees. Shump runs the Philadelphia Bee Company. He says people with allergies have been flocking to him like bees to this hive. They're his main source of business, so he set up hives throughout the city and markets the honey by location.
You know, I get people responding all the time when they hear, you know, oh, you're an urban beekeeper. It's like, oh, do you make local honey? And it's like, yes. And it's like, that's good for allergies, isn't it? And, you know, my response is, you know, I'm torn between telling them, yes, absolutely, and, well, technically speaking, we're not really sure.
So is it any good for allergies?
The truth is, if you look through the literature, there is not a lot of credible published information that it actually works for anything.
T.V. Rajan teaches pathology at the University of Connecticut School of Medicine. About 10 years ago, he sought an answer to the honey allergy question. He says the theory is based on a concept called oral tolerization. Think of it this way. Your immune system is an attack dog.
A very, very violent and very effective attack dog.
Its mission is to defend your body, but you still have to train it to recognize friends and relatives. Rajan says allergies occur when the immune system, that attack dog, overreacts. It thinks pollen is an enemy when it's really not. So the idea is if you ingest honey containing traces of local pollen from bees, you can train your immune system to recognize those allergens as friends instead. Rajan put this theory to the test in a 2-year randomized controlled study. It was small, about 3 dozen participants. The results?
That it clearly does not work for adults.
Rajan says he still gets a lot of calls about this decade-old study, partly because there's just not a lot of research out there. Dr. John Cohn runs a busy allergy practice and is professor of medicine at Thomas Jefferson University.
If you're happy, I'm happy.
It's relatively harmless if you're not allergic to it. It's certainly, there are many things people have done that are much more dangerous ways to treat themselves.
Cohn says the honey concept also falls short because bees probably don't bring enough of common spring allergens, like grass and trees, into the honey. And even if they did, the levels probably wouldn't be very high. But his main concern is if people do have bad allergies and then still skip effective, proven drug treatments that could really help them. Back at Reading Terminal Market, Grace Kennedy stares at the shelf of honey for a few minutes. She finally picks a jar and heads to the checkout counter.
Looks really good.
Kennedy acknowledges there may not be scientific backing to the honey theory.
Partly, maybe it's psychosomatic, but I really do think that it helps.
For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Carolyn Beeler, Alana Gordon, and Todd Bookman. Avery Brookins just finished her internship with us, and we want to thank her for all the great work she's done. We predict a fabulous career for her, so don't forget the little people, Avery. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Joel Patterson, our managing editor, Megan Pinto, our executive producer. Chris Atulo is vice president of news, and Christine Dempsey, our chief content officer. Did you miss some of this show or any of our previous shows? Subscribe to our podcast. It's on iTunes or at our website, whyy.org/thepulse. That's also where you can get in touch with us, ask us anything, give us feedback, send us ideas. We love it. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a generous leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands gladly support WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.